Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia. Just had a great chat with Professor Scott Trappy from Ball State University. It was really, really nice to talk to him because, you know, I did my master's at Ball State University with the great Professor David Kostel. So we talked about him quite a lot because Scott did his PhD there and he became a postdoc and eventually he became the director and has been there for many years. So we talked a lot about what a great environment that was to work in and just the, you know, the effect that Ball State University and David Kostel has had over the years. So if you look back through the podcast, you'll see the first person I had on was Andy Coggan. He went to Ball State. Brett Goodpaster was the second. He went to Ball State. Julian Zarath was on like last week. She was at Ball State. Was it Mark Hargraves? Has been on the podcast. He went to Ball State. John Hawley. So just an incredible, you know, contribution to science, and it's ongoing with Scott Trappy and his team. So you know, we talked about exercise in space. So you know, first of all, talking about you know the incredible effects that space actually has on the body. So a loss of fluid volume, blood volume, all sorts of you know distribution of fluid changes. The reduction in muscle mass, effects on bone, effects on the muscles, contraction, speed, fiber type changes, et cetera. And then whether exercise can actually attenuate this. And then the thing I didn't realize was even, you know, very early on when John Glenn went up to circumnavigate the world in space in 1962, even then he was doing some exercise. So it's been recognized sort of right from the start how important exercise is. So a really interesting chat. I think you'll enjoy it. So hang around. Hey, hi, Scott. Thanks for coming on Inside Exercise. How are you doing, mate?
Hey, Glenn. Good to see you. Good to be here. Look forward to our chat.
Yeah. Actually, I was just thinking before, the last time I saw you, we went and saw a band. It was called Big Head. Someone? Was it Big Head
Todd? Oh, Big Head Todd the Monsters. Oh, I just saw them maybe a month ago again. I love those guys.
It was funny because I thought, what was the name of that band we saw? And I thought, Big Head Todd. And I thought, I wonder if that's a bit of a sibling rivalry thing.
No.
Todd Trappy.
I first hooked up with them when I was doing my graduate studies out in Colorado back in the 80s.
Yeah. So is that where they're based? Is that what they are? Like, I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
They're based out of Boulder.
That was probably what that would have been like 15. Oh, that was a while ago. Shit, man.
That would have been 89 for me. So I graduated from undergrad in 89 and then went right into graduate school.
Okay. But when we saw them, where was that? Oh, I had no idea.
I think we got lucky. Just they were touring through, and when we were at a conference or whatever, maybe San Diego's ringing a bell, but
yeah,
hard telling.
Was that called? Was that called Yell at the Moon or something? Is that the name of the I can't remember. I think the place we went to was like Scream at the Moon or some bloody thing. All right, now, it's great to have you on. So thanks for coming on. You're a busy man. And I see you've got the new Ball State merchandise. So I was just showing you this before we came on, yeah? So people may not know, although I bring it up every 2 minutes, that I did my master's at Ball State. So here's that from 1990, the 25-year sort of, I don't know, reunion or celebration or something, 25 years of Ball State with David Kostel's lab, yeah? 1965 to 1990. And now, what are we up to? You're a better mathematician than me.
Oh, we're 56, I think.
Wow.
So those shirts, those retro shirts, they're back in play. We have the kids love them around here nowadays. So we got them. We're making those again.
Cool. Retro.
Right, and I think you and I just missed overlapping, Glenn. I think when you left, it was like 2 months later or so when I came in as a student.
Wow. Yeah, it must be. We'll get to it later, but I was just having a look yesterday and good old Jeff Woodrick, who was like my best buddy pretty much back then. He was on like one of those first papers, you know, one of those early papers that you were on, et cetera. So yeah. That's great. Yeah, so the history with Ball State. Okay, so why don't we just, I can't help talking about the great man, Doc David Kostel. Why don't we just tell people a little bit about, you know, how you got to be at Ball State and then, you know, who you took over from, not just your average chappy.
I think, you know, it goes when I swam in college at the University of Northern Iowa, and I was, you know, that's what sort of funneled my interest into the field, which, as you know, was much less developed back in the 80s. You know, you didn't need degrees in exercise science and that type of thing. I got connected with the right people in undergrad. It's like, oh, you can make a living doing this. I went to graduate school at the my master's degree at the Olympic Training Center out in Colorado Springs. I was worked for U.S. Swimming in the swimming foam complex. Awesome experience. My thesis committee was John Trope, Ed Burke, and Leo DeQuisto. And when I was deciding, I thought, well, I'd like to maybe move on for a PhD. I went to talk to those guys, and they all had graduated from Ball State.
Oh my gosh. So
that was sort of the funnel. So then I came here in 91 to start the PhD program with Dave. And Dave would have been at that point about the age I am now. I'm 56. And that's when, you know, I had met Dave, I think, before that at a meeting or two, you know, something like that. But, you know, came here and, you know, slowly got to know him as a student. As you know, it's a very open environment. We all, the students and the faculty, we all roll together, collect data together. It's lighthearted. So you really got to know Dave in that capacity as a student. Very nice. And then he was back into swimming. He grew up swimming initially, and then got into the running as part of the whole exercise boom. You know, that whole thing took off. And then the lab was just hitched its ride to that. Dave and the lab and the stuff they were doing was phenomenal. In fact, when I go back and look at some of that stuff, the thing that like Dave was doing and Saltine and Edgerton and Galnick and those guys, right? There was no IRB. It was relatively, you know, new. Dave was the first individual in the US to do the biopsies in the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, just the path they carved there for a period of time was, you know, phenomenal. So then, you know, Dave was back in the pool just for his joints and stuff. So I was also swimming, still swim with him today. In fact, today I swam with him. So that's really kind of how I got to know Dave, was just, you know, through the program. And, you know, I know a lot of programs are structured different. But just the structure and the camaraderie of the lab was really open, and you really had a chance to get to know Dave and the team.
Yeah. And I realized, just as I was getting ready to talk to you, that this is the third in a row. This just gives you a feeling that it's still going on, even though, you know, you said before you even started your PhD, there's three guys, because this is the third in a row. It's just worked out, guest who went to Ball State. So, because we had, Andy Coggan just put up again. He's been on twice. And then Julian Zarath and you. Who else? And then I was there as well. So, pardon?
It's a good company to be involved with.
Yeah. And then Mark Hargraves, who I've had on, and Brett Goodpastor, who I've had on.
Brett and I were doctoral students at the same time. So Brett and I got to know each other riding bikes and being in the lab. Mm-hmm. And Brett and I are right now collaborating on a number of projects together as well. So, you know, our friendship's grown through the years.
Great. And sometimes I wonder, it was a bit, you know, big shoes to fill, you know, and you've obviously done amazingly well. But, you know, what was that? What's that been like? And you obviously have, you know, your answer like someone that's like, hang on, this is my lab now. Let's move on. You know, you still hang out and you swim with the guy, you know.
I never thought about it. It was just kind of, it was a long transition, if you want to know the truth, because, you know, I was a doctoral student and you come in, the program at that point was 3 years. And I remember in the middle of my second year, I was loving it. I was like, I chose the right thing to do with my career. Mm-hmm. I was just immersed in it. I love the lab environment, the projects, the completion. I was learning for the first time how to, you know, scientifically write, really, you know, push this stuff out. And, you know, your time was limited. It's like, I want to take in as much as I can possibly get before I get out of the program. And as I was heading into my third and final year of the program, I got an offer to stay on as a postdoc to work with NASA in the project that Dave and DeCostel and Bob Fitz were, you know, getting involved with. In fact, it was kind of a funny meeting. Dave called me in to act like I had a bit of a behavioral issue. I was absolutely crushed. He called me in about staying for the NASA thing, and he was, you know, kind of couched in the frame that, you know, there was this issue in the lab, and then he just, you know, I was sunk. And he he smiled, and you know,
you say he was just stirring you up. Is that what you say?
Yeah, he was just stirring me up.
Oh my gosh, the sense of humor that guy has.
He probably doesn't remember that. So it was an easy decision to stick around to work with him and Bob. So Fitz had been involved with NASA for quite a long time, probably a decade or longer, doing animal research. And in the human research, you know, from the 60s up until that point in humans was primarily cardiovascular, orthostatic intolerance, loose measurements on muscle and things like that. So they were moving forward to seeing all the changes that were happening in the animal muscle to do some with the humans. So Dave and Bob hooked up, Bob with his sort of cellular biology, physiology background, and then Dave with his experience with the muscle biopsy technique and whole muscle stuff. And then their relationship went back to Cortland when Dave was
coach. He's like a runner, right?
And Bob was one of the runners on Dave's team, you know, back then. So their friendship and relationship went way back. I didn't know all that when I was agreeing to stay on, right? That came to light, you know, as we went through. And then, you know, frankly, we just didn't know the door we were walking through with that, because it's like, oh, it's exciting. You know, we're going to do NASA. They had written a grant. They were funded to do a space shuttle project, which was going to do some whole muscle testing, take muscle biopsies of the gastroc and soleus before and after flight. And then as part of that, I would be spending extra time up at Bob Fitz's lab to learn how to do the single fiber technique, which I was interested in just for my own personal interest. So it seemed like an awesome match. And, you know, when it took off, we were in it, involved early on. We were sort of getting our bearings with all the NASA lingo and the people. And, you know, we were entering a major big team, right? It was not just the science teams that were going to be on with this that we were all meeting. It was the NASA infrastructure team to manage the project, operations, flight studies. You know, so it was kind of like drinking through a fire hose, you know, early on, you know, with that stuff. It involved way more.
Hang on a minute. Sorry. Drinking. I've got to think about that's when I'm not drinking through a fire hose. Just explain that to me.
Oh, that's sort of like, it's an analogy. I guess it must be a U.S. analogy. I'm sorry. Like, you know, firemen, when they're like putting out a fire. So the amount of information and stuff that it's coming is at a high rate.
I see. Okay. I like that. All right.
So, you know, we were traveling a lot and just adapting as we went, and the whole project kind of sprung out, you know, from there. So, you know, at the end of the day, that was roughly 3-year postdoc, if you will, this NASA experience, which continued. Then we walked through that and ended up evolving into space station studies. We've been still involved with. We've done 4 international bed rest studies. So we were going through that whole phase. And then as I was sort of winding down the postdoc, the discussion was sort of like, you know, again, I'm getting out to taking the next step. And exercise science generally was expanding in the US, the idea of it to kind of replace in physical education. Faculty slots were opening up all over the place. There was one open here at Ball State. So it was sort of like we were working on the idea of building up a single fiber station here in the lab, given the investment I'd made up at Bob's lab. And, you know, he was instrumental in me being able to do that. And then the infrastructure of the lab team between Dave's overall leadership and then Gary Lee, who, you know, is the technician, and others.
Is he still there?
He's still here.
Holy mackerel.
Gary's got 2 years left with us. It'll be 40 years he's been with the lab, and he's been phenomenal in the development of the lab and moving us forward.
Wow.
So faculty position opened up. We were setting up the single fiber station in the laboratory. I was beginning to learn how to do muscle biopsies myself. We're beginning in sports performance, which that's what I was interested in with my swimming background and taper and what's changing with the muscle. And then beginning to get interested in aging, because my dissertation had done the aging distance runners. Dave, after 25 years, he tested all the, you know, local, regional, national Olympic champions from the late 60s, early 70s. He was bringing them back for a follow-up. So I was involved with that.
Well, sorry, can I interject? Do you know that he came down to us? So Dave Costell came down to Melbourne during my PhD. So it was 1990, I think, or 1991. And he retested Derek Clayton, and I was in charge of the Douglas bags.
Mark and his team has just retested Derek recently.
Oh, I did not know that.
And his data's quite phenomenal. It's motivational to keep going.
Ooh. Yeah, so it was 1991 or something. And it was the 25-year follow-up. Yeah, because I didn't put that together.
We're a little over 50 years now.
Yeah, so Dave Costa comes down, and I'm doing my PhD with Mark Hargraves, and they've decided, you know, to put me in charge of the Douglas bags. I'm kind of nervous. We almost ran out of Douglas bags, you know. So Dave Costa standing there, Mark Hargraves standing there. I'm like, can one of you guys empty one of those bags?
That was the thing, though, with the lab here and the atmospheres. You got to do it as a student, right?
Yeah.
So one of the last people we tested for what was my dissertation, but Dave's bigger study with these runners, was Frank Shorter. So the night before, I'm setting up the treadmill because we're going to VO2 max test him in the morning. I'm standing over it, making sure the mouthpiece is set up. Everything's just, you know, double, triple, quadruple checking, you know, 10, yeah. you know, slip out of the lab, you know, in the evening, sort of nervous. Okay, we're all set for tomorrow. We're good. Next day, we're going about it, got the team in the lab, Frank's on the treadmill, all hooked up.
Just tell people that Frank Shorter won the 1972 Olympic marathon, just so people know. Yeah,
yeah, he was Olympic champion in 1972, and should have been in 76 as well.
Okay.
So he's on the treadmill, and next thing you know, he's pointing, basically turning blue, so we had to stop the test. They're looking at it. I had the valve in backwards. I checked it so many times. Kostel's just off to the side, and he, you know, gets the classic Kostel. He's like, Jesus. And he's
Jesus.
Who put this together? And, you know, I'm sort of like, oh, I did. It got going again. But, you know, the point is, we were in the middle of the action as students. We were setting this up. We were helping running the test. And I think that is a big part, the hands-on experience.
Well, you're right, because here they've got Derek Clayton is like the world best, you know, time in 1969 that wasn't broken until 1981, you know, and he was 2 minutes faster than the fastest in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Here he is, like, you know, at 50 or something. And we're max testing him, you know, following up David Kostel's N=1, you know, physiology of a world champion paper from 1969. And I'm like, okay, so who's doing the bags? You know, because you got Mark Hargraves, David Costa. Yeah. You are. And, you know, it's a great, you know, it's a compliment, right? They put the confidence in, because you're not going to, you screw up, you know, Derek Clayton, Dave Costa's flown down from the US to do it. What are you going to do? Like, get him back in? You know, he probably would, probably. But anyway, yeah, I almost did screw it up because it was on the last.
You're just kind of noodling around this thing. Next thing you know, it's like you're at the epicenter of the testing.
Yeah, and he almost blew up because he kept going. Because, you know, you got a time when you have Douglas bags and we only had like seven of them. You got to decide when to start. And he just kept going. So it sounds like you're saying he's still impressive. So I thought, oh, he's close. I'll start collecting the bags. Because I did a few submax, and he was literally on the last bag. And I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Do we have any bags left? Start emptying the earlier ones.
I still wonder. I'm like, oh, fuck, did he stop because the bag was too full? But I don't know. He was gone. But yeah. Go back and look at that data. No, I'm just joking. All right, so that's great. Stuff. What great stuff, huh?
Yeah, all right. It's awesome. So, ultimately from there, we just kind of, you know, that kind of just morphed into Dave retired. And they had Bill Kramer was here for 3 years. Just, it wasn't a good fit. I had the opportunity to stay and, you know, get involved with helping lead the lab. And, you know, there was such a great team in place. Yes. And Dave was very helpful in that transition with me sort of being a young investigator, you know, at the time. But we were having some success with our projects and our funding. But we were still involved with the spaceflight stuff. Dave and I were going to Russia together to take biopsies and do different things. So he was like retired from the headaches of the job, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he was still involved helping out with the spaceflight experiments and stuff. So, you know, this went on for quite some time. So, you know, my relationship evolved with Dave from a mentor to friend, you know, through that whole process, traveling, just getting to know him. So I never felt like I was like, had shoes to fill or something like that. It, yeah, to me, it just felt like a continuation.
Yes.
The lab, and then frankly all the alumni have been always so supportive of what we've done, and they've got good students, they send them to us, and you know, so to me it's been like one big continuation versus, you know, taking over.
Yeah, and it's like I was thinking how I even started off over there, and it's all because, you know, everyone knows each other, and they all like get on well with Dave. And so my undergrad at Wollongong Uni, the guy who was the head of the department was Frank Pike, and he'd actually come over and done some work with Dave, and he ended up being like the first Australian to play on an NFL team. He was the kicker. It was Australian rules footballer, and you get kicked like crazy, and I couldn't believe how far he could kick. So anyway, he suggested, you know, I was like, oh, I want to end up doing, you know, metabolism and do biopsies and all that. He said, well, go to David Kossel's lab. So just awesome.
Yeah.
All right, so how about we get stuck in here with the actual sort of science here. So sure. So what I think might be a good way to start off is just to think about, you know, what actually happens when you go up to space, which is just, it's just an incredible thing to even think about, isn't it? So in terms of, obviously you've got the microgravity, so you haven't got the gravity, but also, or very little, also the radiation, I guess. But if we think about, you know, what's actually happening to fluid volumes and things, you know, before we start talking about muscle atrophy and all that, like, yeah. So what's, because I even see you get your eyes squashed from the squashed eyeballs and things.
There's a big adjustment when you go to space. The physiology is completely different in the space environment. It's a big fluid shift. When you remove the gravity, it all kind of floats up to your head, right? So the first week, you just new homeostasis, equilibrate. You urinate off a lot of plasma volume. Your blood volume's down because of, you know, the baroreceptors, and you're just unloading fluid for, you know, several days just to sort of take the pressure off. And if you know anybody or see pictures of the crew members on Earth, when you see them in space, even after, you know, they're up there for periods of time, their face is always just a little bit swollen, right? Just from all the, you know, fluid shifts and stuff go on. So, you know, for certain tasks and stuff you're doing in space, it's no big deal. But overall, cardiovascular capacity goes down, you know, a ton. Changes heart dynamics, changes orthostatic intolerance, changes fluid dynamics, you know, so just that alone is just a huge impact upon, you know, entry into the microgravity environment.
Yeah, and I saw
those changes happen pretty quickly.
Okay. So I saw Ben Levine has obviously done a lot of stuff, yeah. And he was talking about the heart becomes more, is it more spherical? Because it's just not like pushed down by gravity or something.
The organs aren't being pushed down, the heart, you know, all that stuff. So there's just, you know, everything's just different. And then as a result, it starts to operate a little bit differently in terms of the overall fluid dynamics throughout the whole system. You know, it's a closed loop system. That stuff just starts to change.
Yeah. So I guess we kind of think of how it is, you know, normally is the way it normally is, obviously.
Yeah.
And then when you take that away, sort of all bets are off. I guess sort of every organ, every system, almost everything's affected in some way.
Yeah. And I think I don't know if I've come across anything that improves. I think everything, you know, is debilitated to some aspect when you think about, you know, the space environment. Like you're saying, eyesight changes for the crew members, the shape of their eyeball changes, blood pressure in your overall head, you know, changes, which impacts ocular pressures, these types of things. Your prescription for glasses, if I have these are just readers.
Really?
If I have these out in space, I probably need different ones. Sometimes, actually, some people don't need glasses in space. Because the shape of the eyeball gets corrected. So maybe that's one caveat to my earlier comment. But, you know, generally speaking, there's just, you know, anything and everything more or less is impacted one way or the other.
All right. So I guess we start thinking about as exercise types, you know, I mentioned the heart. So I know the heart gets smaller and things like that. So maybe if we think about, I don't know how you want to do this, but maybe if we think about like what happens to the, you know, the heart and the muscle and the bones and, you know, the kind of obvious things. And then, you know, fiber type changes and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
And then we could think about what exercise, you know, can exercise minimize these changes? Can it prevent the changes? All that sort of stuff. So do you mind if we
if we start like, you know, the one thing the heart has going for it is it's always working. Right. So the atrophy you see in the heart muscle is less than you see in peripheral skeletal muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact on muscles depend on where it's at in the body. So like what we've seen, like, is in control subjects, because the astronauts are working up in space, the crew members, right? And they're doing a variety of things, and they do have exercise baked into their equation. So you never get a true control. When you look at the long duration bed rest, we've had people in bed for 90 days, nothing. And they do the head down tilt, so the fluid shifts are the same, mimics the space environment. You see about over 3 months, about 10% loss in heart volume. You'll see about 20% loss in the thigh muscles, which is equivalent to like a 25-year-old. And that's what you see in 50 years worth of aging.
Wow.
In 3 months. And if you look at the lower leg, the calves, because the toes pointed down when you're up in space, you'll see 30% loss in the muscle mass.
Oh, the toes are pointed down.
So,
calves are shortened.
Yep, calves are shortened. So they're 30% loss in muscle mass from the calves, 20% in the thighs. Upper body's less affected. Maybe 5-10%, and then they're using their upper body a lot, you know, to do a variety of things. So depends on where, you know, so we kind of in the lab here view it in thirds, sort of above the trunk is X percent, and then, you know, from the trunk to the knees, and then from the knees below. So from an exercise or any type of countermeasure, it's not a one size fits all, even within the same person, because of the different parts of the body are affected in different ways.
That's interesting, because that's almost convenient, because I was thinking about, you know, if you're doing like runners, you tend to want to biopsy the gastroc and or the soleus. If you're doing cyclists, you'll do the quads. And if you're doing like a swimming, you do the deltoid. It's almost the same sort of breakdown, maybe, if you want to do that.
Well, with the pre-post flight and our bed rest stuff, we biopsied three different muscles of the leg. So the vastus lateralis, which is a common one, the gastrocnemius, and the soleus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The soleus is the most impacted because it's a slow muscle. It's, you know, 80% all slow fibers. And when you unload the body, the slow fibers are much more affected. They atrophy, they decrease in their contractile properties significantly. Fast fibers are also affected, but not necessarily to the same degree. So these muscles atrophy at different rates. The fibers respond differently, depending on what muscle they're in and where they're located in the body.
So at first I went, hang on, why are the slow fibers? But is that because they're sort of postural? They're meant to be sort of working the whole time sort of thing?
Yeah, I think so. I think it doesn't, in some respects, it doesn't take a whole lot for a slow fiber to be happy, I'll say. You know, postural, just standing around, walking around, going to the store, daily activities, the soleus is fine. In fact, we did a class where kind of a light bulb went off for me. So we were hosting a marathon class here at the university for undergraduates with no previous real running or marathon experience. To qualify for the class, you had to be able to run for 30 minutes without stopping, but you didn't have, you couldn't have run a previous marathon. So we walk them through a training program. We took biopsies of them before and after the 16-week training program. When we looked inside the soleus muscle, like a classic stuff gland, mitochondrial stuff, aerobic enzymes, capillary profile, all these sort of, you know, classic markers, they were so high pre-training that they didn't even change with all the training. The vastus went up like you might expect would happen with endurance training, more aerobic enzymes, more capillaries, and they met where the soleus was at. So just walking around doing stuff, the soleus is like, I view it as just, as long as you're ambulatory and leading normal
activity, almost like the heart.
Yep, exactly. They're being used.
So as long as, isn't it? Like, it is nowadays, a lot of people don't actually just normally ambulate.
No, and so then you've got the issue with when you remove that, when you go to space, it's devastating for those fibers and those muscles. Right. But it also then affects circulation in the muscle pump, right? Because a lot of the muscle pump for, you know, flow back to the heart, and, you know, those dynamics start to change because you don't have loading on the muscles. So it's all kind of, you know, we like to look at stuff in silos, but the reality is all this stuff's connected. and all these systems kind of get affected, you know, across the chain link.
Exactly. So we're integrated, and it's become more and more clear throughout exercise physiology and everything that how integrated we are, and we still are in space, I guess. Makes sense. Yeah.
And then you get looking right now, the big thing is like where they're going, you know, back to the moon here soon, and you know, anything they're going to go further. But given what's evolved in the sort of exercise physiology world, that we know that we have organ communication and all these things going on now, how's this affected in the space environment? You got a lot of potential DNA damage because of the radiation exposure and stuff that's going on. And, you know, if the muscles are atrophying and affected and the fiber types are changing and all these things, what chemicals are being released from the muscle that communicate with other organs? Is that different than here on Earth? I would say it's, you know, the overall communication patterns and stuff are probably somewhat similar, but they're probably altered. But we don't know. That's never really been looked at. They took a peek at it with the twin study, just through some blood work, looking at all the different sort of profile signatures, you know, the change with flight. So that was a snapshot. But I think given what we know and has evolved, particularly over the last 20 years, that emanated out of the work in Copenhagen with IL-6 and, you know, these whole ideas of muscles and endocrine organ, and it's such a driver because it's such a large portion of our body weight, and how that starts to communicate with, you know, the liver, the bone, the brain, and the heart, and all these things are connected. It's in some ways it's more complicated than we probably realize, but it makes total sense that there's a traffic system on behind the scenes that's talking to each other.
Okay, so just thinking about the fluid shifts, I saw Ben Levine, who was actually on the pod, you know, you could get him on to talk about three or four different things. So he came on the podcast early on talking about the heart and exercise, you know, can you do too much? And so he's had that, what is it? It's a sleeping bag sort of thing with the pressure to try and keep more pressure in the legs. Is that sort of been, you know, integrated into the International Space Station, or is that still something
that off and on? You know, so that's a lower body negative pressure unit. You go back, they actually had one on Skylab. And then
what was that one, Skylab?
That was back in the 70s. So that's a U.S. based lab where they put them up there for, you know, 1 month, 2 months, and 3 months, which was very novel at the time. This was in the 70s. And they had a bike up there. The first VO2 maxes in space were done on Skylab. They had a lower body negative pressure unit where they could get into and change the fluid shifts around and stuff. So that stuff's been part of the culture in NASA for a long time. They've done it a lot with ground-based studies. We've been involved with some where you just have a lower body negative pressure anchored into a treadmill to change the overall dynamics. Right now, to my knowledge, there's not a lower body negative pressure unit on the space station. They have a bicycle ergometer that can do 350 watts. They have a treadmill, and they have a resistance exercise device. And, you know, and those are all engineered and developed for the space environment because it's tricky business. So weights don't work in space, right? So you have hydraulics. And then, you know, all this stuff has to be isolated from the space station because, you know, if you're running on the treadmill, that pounding and stuff, you know, the treadmill or those solar
instruments
and stuff would just get moving and stuff on the space station. So that stuff's all, if you look at videos that you find on YouTube and stuff, this stuff's all isolated from the rest of the station so it doesn't cause vibrations.
Okay.
So just the engineering feat to have simple, a bike, a treadmill, and then, you know, a resistance exercise device, which is multi-body, right? You can do upper body, you can do squats, you can do bench. It's all isolated from the space station.
So it's, I'm assuming it's more than just, because I was thinking just bands, you know, having bands or whatever would work. Yeah. Would that work?
I guess rudimentary, but you just need higher loading. And the thing is, when we first got involved with the space station stuff, they were working out, you know, we kind of titrated two things out. One was what was happening to the muscle when they were up there, but also what exercise were they doing? Because it was a little bit of a hodgepodge, right? What do you like, Glenn? What do you like, Scott? You know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of the idea they were doing enough and it was taking care of everything. But some of the devices, particularly the resistance exercise device, didn't have high loads. So they made up for it with volume. They did tons of volume. And, you know, come to find out, it was, you know, maybe about 50% effective what they were doing. It just wasn't enough quality. So, you know, the bands and stuff probably aren't going to get you there because it's just not going to be the loads that you need, and particularly for some of the larger muscle groups and whatnot. So the device they ultimately put up was, which is referred to as the ARED, is excellent for loading. It would be like what you could get for loads if you went into a good gym.
How does that work? Can you just kind of...
Well, you can configure this to do about any exercise you would like, right? So squats and bench and upper body and crunches, and it's all computer controlled. So it's set up behind the scenes with different wheels and hydraulics. And
hydraulics. So
I would have a program that was for me if I was flying. You'd have one for you that was flying. You could go in there and load that, and then, you know, go through your basic routine, which is very structured now. It incorporates, you know, best practices, you know, with that 3 to 4 days a week for resistance. You know, you got a dose treadmill, and the same thing there. You got to, you know, jog, but you got to incorporate a few intervals into it. And then the same with the bike. So kind of what they were doing before was just sort of exercising, kind of, I'll call it for fitness. Yeah. And now we're training them like athletes. Wow. That was the big difference. It was a big shift, because there's a lot of layers involved with NASA, the medical operations, the safety of the crew is paramount. So there was concern that if you got into more of the high quality exercise, you were actually going to injure the crew. Mm-hmm. And it was very similar to the debates that was happening with the aging research early on, that was sort of concluding that older people don't adapt as well. But when you really pulled back the curtain on the exercise routine they were doing, it was soft.
It slipped.
Right? So, but when you stimulated the older people with what we would consider a high intensity exercise program, they responded very well. Mm-hmm. And it was that sort of same mentality concept out of safety for the crew, right? But really, they began to realize, and the crew members were eager to help out as they were seeing the data and learning. They helped champion this transition, that the risk for injury was actually higher if you didn't do the higher quality exercise. So the whole thing got baked in more like training the crew members like athletes.
Yeah, so I wonder if we could just talk about the time frame, because I know, is it 6 months, the normal International Space Station? I know you said, you know, if we go to the moon, like, or maybe not the moon, but going to Mars, it's going to be how long? I don't know.
But, yeah, well, the typical, when we got involved with the space station research, our average was right around 6 months of the crew members we were studying. That was the typical stay. Mm-hmm. I think they were going to titrate stuff out a little different, but it just started hitting these rhythms of about 6 months. As you know, they've been exploring longer duration. Scott Kelly was up there for a year. It was a planned mission. Some of these with logistics of the ships, getting them back and forth, people end up there longer, but they are now experimenting with keeping people up there for a full year. There's fewer people have done that. We have a lot of data on 6 month. The moon missions will go back to being relatively short. I think the goal is to eventually build up, you know, a program that people are spending more time on the moon. You'll probably have some type of natural countermeasure from being on the moon, given the 1/6 G that happens from the loading. So we're going to have some partial loading that probably helps, you know, mitigate some of these losses.
Sorry. So the moon is 1/6 of Earth's gravity. Yeah. So 1/6 G. Okay.
1/6 G. And, you know, depending on where you look, but the general planning is, if you go to Mars, it's 6 months to Mars, 6 months on Mars, 6 months back. But you see variety. It depends. You want to launch these in windows. You got to have supply ships that are out in advance, you know, that they're going to catch up with.
But Elon's going to go and live on Mars, though, right? Isn't that the idea?
Well, I think some people wouldn't mind that.
You know, like, we've screwed up this world, so let's go live on Mars. It's like,
but I tell you, SpaceX has been awesome. They've really contributed, the commercial enterprise, to moving all this along. We've got a more of a constant cadence going up to the space station. We're going to be sending, you know, some of these to the moon, around the moon. They got a program, the Gateway. They're going to start going out for 30 days and back into deep space. So we're going to start, my view of this, we're going to start biting this off in bite sizes to learn how to go to Mars. So we'll go back to the moon, use that as a platform, you know, and then go a little bit deeper, use that as a platform, stay for longer periods. We have people on the International Space Station for a year. You know, the big thing, I think, you know, any of these things, there's huge risk involved with something like this. But, you know, one of the big challenges that are pressure points, all there's a ton of them, but one I'll highlight is these transition states, right? So like when the crew member's up on the space station for 6 months, and then we typically would get our muscle biopsies within a few hours of landing.
So I saw that. I thought that was crazy. You know, they get back, they want to see their families. And
if they start walking around and doing a lot, we get a lot of damage to the muscle, and then it just blows the assays completely up. So they get back, get to get some clinical operations, get measured, get to say hi to their families and stuff, and then get ushered over to us. And we would typically have the biopsy 6 to 8 hours after.
I was impressed to see that. I just thought they must have so much stuff going on when they get back, you know, so that's great.
They do. And it's been a very interesting experience and a privilege to be involved.
Can I just ask, are they like kind of freaked out? Like, are they... Because, you know, you see like a snapshot, you know, when they get off waving and all that. Are they like freaked out? Like, it must be mentally, you know, it must just be a total freak out, you know, ridiculous. I'm not using good terminology here, but just to go up to space.
They say that stuff, the right stuff. These people have the right mentality. My impression, we've interacted with we've done 30 crew members, Russian, American, and then a handful of other agencies, French, Canadian. Anyway, you get that international flavor that have been involved with their projects. And, you know, when they come back, they're in great moods. They're a little worn out. It's a lot because, you know, for their 24, 48 hours prior to departure on the station, they're busy, right? There's a lot going on there for them to close up shop, for them to come back. And then the transition back, which is pretty quick by the time they undock to actually land, it doesn't take that long, a couple hours. And then, you know, the return to gravity is, you know, a lot with transition, particularly the orthostatic intolerance. But I tell you that they're in great moods. They're happy to be home. They're surprisingly, we're going to do biopsies. They've been happy to see us.
I was thinking that's probably the last thing they feel like. But yeah,
they're in great. My experience has been they're in great spirits. They're interested in helping out. They are all very interested in the science and helping.
Yeah.
Forward. So they're kind of lab rats, if you will, with all this stuff. You know, these are low-end studies and just keep accumulating. They champion the cause for that. So they're phenomenal individuals.
Actually, can I say something I thought of? You know, I mentioned Derek Clayton earlier. So when he came back in the 1990, the 25-year follow-up, we muscle biopsied him. And he went F. And I was like, oh, crap, what happened? Did it hurt? And he's like, no, he was swearing. He was pissed off that he didn't do it in 1969 because they wanted to biopsy it. Dave wanted to biopsy him then, but he didn't want to. You know, he's world record holder and whatever in the marathon. And, you know, he was worried about it. And he's like, that was nothing. And he was literally just really pissed off, you know, that he didn't have it. So I wanted people to realize that these biopsies, I've had 33 of them. They're not that bad. And
I've had my fair share. So, you know, it's well tolerated, as you know.
What about with the atrophy? You can't find their muscles anymore. No, I'm just joking.
Gastroc can be a little challenging after 6 months up in space. Really? Soleus, you know, but we've been fortunate, successful. And then when we do the biopsies, it's generally just us, the crew, and the flight surgeon. So it's a good protected environment. We walk the crew through everything. And then the post-flight is a little less drama with it because they had the pre-flight. So they've been through it. They know what to expect since they've already been biopsied before.
Of course.
So at that, and they're kind of, to be honest with you, they're sort of tired. You just sort of doing your thing, and you know, they're just cool with the whole thing, and you're going about your business,
I meant to say they're interested in the science. Obviously, that's what they're there for, and that was the thing with Derek Clayton. He wanted to know what is my fiber type change. He wanted to know the science, and that's obviously by definition, astronauts are, they want the science, right? I mean,
yeah. So they've been super with the whole thing. It's been great.
Can I ask you a totally sort of different question? So the guy on Twitter that's been great sending questions through quite often is Mark Preben Lindbeck, I think. And it's something I hadn't heard about. He said, how is appetite regulated in space? What mechanisms might be in play? Interventions, medications. So do they lose, I guess they, it's hard to tell because they lose weight from their fluid losses, but do they lose weight? Do they put on weight? I mean, the food must be terrible.
They lose weight generally. I think it varies a little bit from crew to crew member, but appetite goes down and the food has extra salt in it, you know, sort of the space food that's dehydrated, and it's okay from what I understand, but it's not like their favorite thing. But the supply missions generally have fresh foods for them and cheeses and stuff. Sort of things for them to kind of enjoy life till it runs out a week or so. But for the most part, they're eating space food, and mm-hmm. they're super busy people because mm-hmm. I think just my understanding is just generally their appetite's suppressed in the space environment.
Right. Okay.
Combine that with a heavy work schedule, right? They got to do everything themselves. So they're running the experiments. They're keeping the space station up and running. You know, they have some dedicated time to communicate with friends and family, you know, exercise time. There's not a ton of downtime for these people. They're running from one thing to another. And if you have something with the space station come up or whatever that requires attention, it's not like you call somebody to fix the plumbing. You do it yourself. No.
And you've got them, like you said, you want them to be athletes as well up there now. So how much exercise are they actually? Because I saw in the papers, when you looked at what they were doing, you know, obviously it was variable because you couldn't, when those initial studies, it was just like, approximately 5 hours, and some were doing more of this and some were doing more of that. How much are they doing now? And I was also thinking, do they actually sweat, and does the sweat just sort of float off somewhere?
Well, they do sweat, and then you got the CO2 buildup, you know, from exercise, you know, that has to, you know, all be managed with the, you know, their in-house systems to scrub all that stuff. So the exercise has gotten smarter, but the volume's like the same. It's just better. It's higher quality.
There you go.
And then they can do some extra, just noodling around. I want to go for a run or whatever, but it's structured time. They have roughly 2 hours of time set aside to exercise a day. But mm-hmm. that includes set up and tear down, right? So we'll call it 90 minutes of good stuff. And, you know, it's periodized as they go through, just like you would with an athlete. So the other thing about it is they look forward to that. That's their protected time. It's good for a variety of things. Not only good for their physiology, it's good for their head, the mental health.
Exactly.
That goes along with it. So, yeah.
Okay, now are you finding, because you touched on earlier how, you know, the exercise they were doing when it was less maybe structured or less intense, they were not able to attenuate, or they could attenuate the muscle wastage.
Yeah, we're getting partial protection. You know, if you looked at it, like if you compared it to like 90 days of nothing, we know kind of what the dramatic aspects of that are. You know, we were probably, with the early space station stuff, protect in half, I'll call it.
Okay.
They didn't lose as much muscle mass. And when you go to space, you see, when you go to space, you see or unload the muscle, you see a shift from slow to fast fibers. The fibers get smaller and they shift. And when you do nothing, like 90 days of bed rest, that shift is dramatic. You're seeing 30, 40, 50% shift in fiber type.
Yeah, that really surprised me.
Can't change is not true. It does. Yeah. They do change. If you go to like the spinal cord injury literature, people that have been wheelchair bound for 3 to 15 years, they have less than 10% of their muscle as slow twitch fibers. They've all just shifted and transformed to this 2X fiber, which is super fatigable. So we mitigated some of that shift, about half of that. So, you know, that was part of the, you know, education for us, for NASA, the crew. And so the idea of training them more like athletes were even better. Frankly, we're not all the way there yet. There's still some challenges, particularly with the lower leg that come up. It's much better. I'd say we cut another half of that off.
Okay. So now they're just losing 25% or something rather than 50.
Probably
or
less. It depends on the muscle, but probably less than that. And some do a little better than others. They're a little bit more diligent. Some people like certain types of exercise more than other. Some people, maybe as an example, my low back bothers me. I can't do the treadmill very well. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's real life stuff or joint issues and, you know, that type of stuff that comes up just like they do with people doing sports on Earth. But I think when you look at it and if you're forecasting some long stuff, we're going to Mars. I think we've come a long way in the countermeasure development with exercise, but we still have a ways to go. And one of the big challenges, I think, for a mission to Mars is going to be right now, we got a suite of three exercise devices up on the International Space Station that are pretty robust. There's just not the room on a planned trip to Mars right now for them. Yeah. And then you're going to have probably six crew. It has to, you know, what do you do if you get halfway to Mars and this thing breaks down? Right. So there's a lot to work out with the devices, the footprint, the CO2 production, the loading to optimize this for, you know, we may look at it for muscle, and we made some great progress with muscle with the various bed rest studies. Because the bed rest studies really are kind of to do two things. One is to test drive a novel exercise prescription to see if it's suitable or better for space. Mm-hmm. And the second is to test novel hardware that may fly in space, because typical hardware that you take from the gym here don't work, right? And then you use those as then, okay, this is working. Let's try this now in the space environment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of aspects to work out, you know, from what the exercise program would be, how robust the hardware is, when you start looking at, you know, leaving Earth's orbit for 18 months. Now, you'll probably get some protection on Mars. That's one third of gravity. So there'll be just some loading on Mars from walk around on Mars, exploring Mars, the suit of Mars, which will help. But oftentimes we found with the space environment, it's kind of interesting that, you know, sometimes you solve a problem and it's great. Sometimes you solve a problem and you create a new problem. And when we got into the higher loading with the resistance exercise, the muscle loved it. The eyeballs did not, because it increased overall blood pressures and things that had effects elsewhere that weren't necessarily as optimal. So it's like, you know, there's a lot of things to work out, and not all the systems don't deteriorate at the same rate, and they don't respond to exercise at the same
rate. Right.
Bone loss happens a little bit slower, but it takes forever to bounce back. They are experimenting with various drugs for bone, bisphosphate and another. I'm not positive they're using those right now. We're not, to my knowledge, using any type of drugs for, you know, performance enhancing drugs that would be happening. Sure. Testosterone's been tested in bed rest. It's not really low dose. We're involved in that study. We're working on writing that stuff up right now, actually. There really wasn't a value add. They didn't have low T, so, you know, adding it on. And then the risk you run into, depending on what pharmacology you're getting into, could have other adverse effects for long-term use down the road. So I think NASA really has taken the position, we'd like to solve this without pharmacology.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's simple things that can be done, Glenn, that always aren't implemented. And I think we've learned a lot in the sports science world, like the timing when to eat relative to exercise and stuff, right? So I think there's some things that low-hanging fruit that could be done with the exercise and timing of eating and stuff, which would maximize the exercise response without any real additional effort. And one of the things that we've learned through the NASA stuff and then applying it to sort of our athlete models of taper and overtraining and then with our aging work is, the NASA stuff is absolutely the opposite of what you would think. It's like, okay, I just do a little bit of exercise, that's not going to be enough. Very low volumes of exercise when unloaded, either in the space environment or bed rest, have a profound positive impact. And our current working theory is we don't have any interfering effects. So when you stimulate the muscle, normally, you know that there's a dynamic time course after exercise where there's the early responders, these sort of triggers that get turned on, right? Mm-hmm. Things get phosphorylated and the mechanisms start to play. And then we have some mid responders, hours, certain genes start getting expressed and stuff. And then, you know, we go a little bit later out, right, with proteins being formed at 24, 48 hours, inflammation panels start to change and calm back down. Protein synthesis gets flipped on 24 to 48 hours. So these all have sort of, you know, different timings depending on the system you're looking at. And it looks like, you know, when the muscle's unloaded and you would stimulate that muscle, the magnitude of the impact is actually higher, not lower.
Okay. It's a relatively more. Yeah.
I think some of it also is there's no interfering effect. You know, if I do an exercise bout, next thing you know, I'm gone doing this, I'm walking to class, you know, whatever it is, I have other stimuli coming in that's counter in some ways to the exercise. So if you just look at a pure exercise effect in unloaded muscle, it's really, really potent.
Okay. Now, this just with the, there's a few things there. I want to talk about the bone some more, but I just thought with, again, with the muscle, the fiber type change, that's really intriguing because, as you said, we tend to think that slow to fast, fast to slow doesn't really happen. It's more sort of within the fast fibers and things. But is that because when you've got sort of normal, you know, physiology, normal walking around or whatever, they don't change. But if you take it, if you've got a spinal cord injured or bed rest or space, if you totally unload, then it switches. Like, does it switch physiologically or not?
Yeah, so much? Kind of, it's a combination, Glenn. I think the early stuff that laid the foundation for you're born with, that's it. You have it. If you're 50% slow, 50% fast, that's it. We think of that quite a bit differently now at the lab. I think a lot of that was, those were great studies. There was nothing wrong with them. The interpretation of their data was spot on. But histology does not have those ATPase type histology techniques from the 70s and 80s didn't have the fidelity to really look at the continuum of fiber types the way we do today. Yes. So we know we have slow fibers, we have fast fibers, we have super fast fibers, we have hybrid fibers, which is a combination of slow and fast in a variety of ways. So it's really a continuum. And if you're inactive, just like an inactive older adult, you might have 30% of the muscle would be in the hybrid form. And if I trained you for 3 months, I can reduce that to 10%. And if I commit you to an endurance exercise protocol, I can drive a lot of those hybrids to be a slow fiber because that's what's desired for endurance exercise. If I do resistance exercise, I can drive a lot of those hybrids to be type 2 fibers because that's really what's called upon for exercise. So we can do a lot of shifting around. Now, when you look at athletes, a lot of that's been engineered out. Even if you get into 80-year-old athletes, 5-10% are hybrids. That's it. The muscle's fit, it's committed, it's doing its thing. It doesn't matter if you're young, it doesn't matter if you're old. If you're, you know, less active, you might have 20% hybrids. If you're kind of sedentary, maybe 30% hybrids. And now if you get inactive and you go to bed, you start to see a combination of way more hybrids and then this shift driving that these hybrids slowly convert to the continuum of being a like this super fast. And I think we don't know the reason. Maybe there's smarter people than I that know this now, but it looks like that's part of the exit program for losing muscle fiber. They atrophy and go through this transition state. And ultimately, that's the sort of apoptotic program that kicks in the 2X fibers and they eventually slough off. So the fiber type profile continuum is a broad range and it's very dynamic based upon physical activity, loading and unloading.
So I saw
early studies were just technique based.
Okay. I saw a paper that was sort of it might have been the Jeff Woodrick one that you were on, but one of the earlier sort of papers, I think you were hypothesizing that maybe what happens is the muscle, because it's atrophying and it's losing a lot of peak power and force, et cetera, if it switches to these stronger, more powerful fiber types, it might be helping to maintain that.
It's kind of a flight or flight thing. So it's more preservation. Mm-hmm. So if you look at like a type 2A fast fiber contracts quicker, that has a higher contractile velocity than a slow fiber. And as a result, it's more powerful. And a 2X is another magnitude up from that. The super fast fiber, it contracts really fast and it's more powerful. So in our early bed rest studies, we actually thought we had a countermeasure that's quite well preserved. The whole muscle power, whole muscle strength looked great. But when we got into our isolating fibers, fiber type, single fiber properties, what really had happened is we had a decent shift from slow to fast fibers, that was happening in the muscle. So we had a different makeup, but because the muscle was faster, had more fast fibers in it, it was masked at the whole muscle level because they could produce more power.
That's a genius move.
It's like, really. Okay, no problem. But short term, maybe that's no problem. But the issue is, like, they had a, at the time, like, if you go to the moon, they typically have a thing like a 10K walk back scenario. So if you're out in the buggy and it breaks down, you got to walk back 10K. Well, you know, Glenn, a type 2 or a type 2X fiber, it's not built for endurance. It's much more fatigable. It uses a different substrate. It's much more carbohydrate-based. So you do start to change the metabolic profile and substrate flux that's going to go on with these fiber type shifts as well. So there's a lot of moving parts that come in with that. So, the biopsy has opened up a window, as you know, from when it was introduced in 1962, looking at substrate use and stuff, and still... what we've learned with the crew and been able to do the biopsies with that in the Bedera studies really has been helpful in helping with prescribing new exercise countermeasures.
Now, what about these shifts in fiber type? So I was thinking, if you wanted to be a sprinter and you were like 50-50, you think, oh, I could lay in bed, head down for 90 days, get more fast twitch fibers, and then become this great sprinter. Yeah. But I'm assuming it switches back again.
Yeah, it does. Well, then the problem is you might have got some shifts that are helpful for running a little bit quicker, but everything, your heart and
fluid volume, less muscle,
everything else is tanked. As you know, we studied a champion sprinter, Colin Jackson, a number of years ago. And when so he came to the lab, we did a biopsy on him, and 25% of his muscle was pure 2X. And if you biopsied you, me, even older people, inactive people, we only see about 2% in this pure 2X form. So I thought there was something wrong in the lab. I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Do it again. So we pulled this new set of fibers, ran everything, and then it came back. And I said, do it again. So we did it three times. And at the end, Colin Jackson was a unique bird. So there are genetics that tied to this, right? You know, you look at the Derek Clayton you're talking about. He has an endurance phenotype, more slow fibers. And then you have like a guy like Colin Jackson who has a sprint phenotype and has these, in fact, you see a lot of these 2X fibers in cheetahs, in animals that can really sprint. So there is that's locked into it. But I think that idea and the histology stuff sort of locked it in. If you're 50-50, that's a lock or whatever. I think it's difficult to move these things around enough in a person to say, okay, I'm going to make you a champion endurance or champion, because it's only one component of many things that come together. Yes. And you can move your fiber type with training around with these hybrid fibers and different stuff. But, there's limits imposed on
that. You know, I was thinking, remember those papers? Who was it? There was a female scientist that had a whole bunch of papers talking about the coexistence of myosin heavy chain isoforms within the single fiber.
Her name's escaping me right now. Yeah, so she did a lot of great work in South Africa.
Yes, I was wondering, when you did the ATPA stain and it said it was a slow or fast fiber, was it just the majority of those coexisting, if you had a majority that was slow, it would come up slow, you know what I mean? If you had a majority, I don't know if you know that. I just wondered how that worked. Is that what you're saying about the hybrid fibers, where you've got like a bit in the same cell, you have a bit of fast and a bit of slow, yeah?
Yeah, even there you can have within the same cell some. And, if you look back at the old myosin ATPase, you were looking at myosin ATPase as an enzyme. Mm-hmm. Where, a lot of the techniques now are anchoring truly to the myosin protein, which has different characteristics than the myosin ATPase does. You could look at other things if you wanted to, the ability for calcium handling and classify it based upon that. I think most people would agree, even today, that the top item to sort of classify a fiber would be the myosin heavy chain. And then that can exist in these multiple forms we're talking about, right? So the myosin head could be a pure type 1, a 2A, a 2X, a hybrid, and some fidelity even. So if you look at a hybrid fiber, it could be 90% slow and 10% fast. It could be 50-50, so even there's so much fidelity.
It's not as straightforward as we used to think, I guess.
No.
Now, just you mentioned Bone before, and I think Angela Davies sent a question, and you touched on it there. She said, "You know, can it take 2 years to recover bone? Suppose the duration of space is a cause of the loss." So, yeah. So, how quickly does bone? I know you're more a muscle guy, but how quickly and how much bone loss do you get, and roughly how long does it take to come back? And it takes longer than how long you were there gone for, I guess.
Well, I'm not a bone researcher, as you know. My knowledge of bone is being involved with NASA and the people who actually study the bone closely. The atrophy of the muscle will precede the bone loss. So the atrophy of the muscle actually in the first month can be actually pretty rapid. Then it tends to kind of stabilize a little bit. It's still decreasing, but the rate is stabilized a bit. The bone starts to change, and then my understanding, everybody's a little bit different. And the recovery from bone, they scan these crew members a year out. They're still not back to where they flew before on some of these. So I think bone's a complex one. It does a lot more than just a skeleton, right? It's an organ.
Exactly.
How it's operating and stuff as well. There's a lot of crosstalk.
Releasing hormones.
They're going back and forth. So I think there's probably a lot more to learn in that space. But, then the issue is you get to a planet, you've got a lot of radiation exposure, which is super hard on so many things, the bone included. And then, what happens if you're on Mars and have a bone fracture?
Yeah.
All right. So there, there's a lot of things. It could just happen because there was an accident, right? But it could happen because your bones have weakened, you've been gone for over a year, and all the different exposures you've had and the loadings loss, and now you're more susceptible to these other types of, injuries and fractures.
Actually, the other thing I was thinking was, I guess you can't really do it with bone. You can't really sort of strengthen your bone before you go on a flight, but I guess muscles, do they look at, when you're having if you're going to have cardiac surgery, it's always good to try and get the person fitter so the heart's going to be able to tolerate it better. Do they do that with astronauts? Do they try and build up the muscle, get them fitter before they go? Does that help?
Well, first of all, exercise is just part of the culture with the crew members.
Right.
And then as they ramp up for a flight, they're actually have a mock-up. They have an astronaut gym down there with the equipment that's also on the ISS. So they're going through their protocols. They're getting trained on those protocols. They're training on the devices. So when they go into space, they're fit.
Okay.
Right. Could they? I know they do get busy to where maybe they could spend a bit more time exercising. But by and large, all the people we've interfaced with, they're fit, and they're going when they go to space, they're fit.
Okay. Now I'm a bit of a glucose man. Glucose uptake during exercise and effective exercise and insulin sensitivity. Have they looked at what happens to, I'm assuming they reduce, their insulin sensitivity goes down while they're gone.
It does.
And is it pretty much what you'd expect?
It varies, right? Because I think in the control subjects in bed rest, it changes big time. And that's really no surprise. Mm. But when you do layer in countermeasures and exercise, it's very protective of these sensitivity issues with glucose, free fatty acid flux, those types of things. So exercise is important for all these reasons we're talking about. Metabolic health is one of those.
Now, the other one, I guess I can't help thinking about exercise and thinking about VO2 max. And I'm assuming you can VO2 max test people before they go, but then when they come back, it's probably not, I don't know. Do you actually VO2 max test them when they get back? You wouldn't be the first day or something, but with the reduction in heart size, reduction in muscle, do you get loss of capillaries? I mean, I guess their VO2 max is down, but is that a routine sort of thing you look at in the first week or so?
We did early on, and that's just a routine measure NASA has implemented that they're looking at with these crew members. So, and they've done some nice in-flight studies too. So if you time course this out, Glenn, the max drops pretty quickly when they go to space, back to what we were talking earlier, just because all the fluid shift volumes and you're just urinating off.
So you're losing your blood volume
losing your blood volume. It's just like if I were to take some blood out and then max test, you go back to the classic Ekblom studies in 72 when they were doing these venous sections and stuff, right? It was just like you take out, 400 or 800 mLs of blood, your VO2 is down 10 or 12%. I mean, it's just, no fitness has changed. It's
just reduced cardiac output. Yeah, yeah.
When you test in the crude, I think they, for risk purposes and stuff, I think the, it's around 2 or 3 days after their return. Okay. And then if you look by a month or so, they're more or less back. So it, it tracks with fluid volume quite a bit, right?
Oh,
with
wow. All
that type of stuff. So it, it can come back pretty quickly just with the fluid aspect and then the fine tuning of it as you sort of recalibrate and get more fit. But, you know, the crew members are off balance and stuff when they first get back and the orthostatic intolerance and stuff. So they, the early testing are usually like stout submax stuff before they run them right up to the edge, just because of all the changes that have come in, that have happened in space and then coming back and re-equilibrating to the Earth environment. You know, they just feel like a big heavy sack.
So I guess they're, what about their heart? Does it, do we know how long, not we, but do you guys know how long the heart sort of takes to come back? You know, its normal shape and left ventricle size and all that
I'm
sort of
not
stuff.
Positive the exact details off the top of my head, right? But it's not usually the atrophy is not as much because it's beaten all the time.
Oh, that's right.
Exercise, but you do see a lot of the, and Ben would be the guy to ask for that because he directly studies it. But you know, a lot of the dynamics change, the twisting of the heart changes, so the overall efficiency in terms of ejection fraction, some of those types of things. My understanding is, you know, it takes a bit before that stuff's actually
that just reminded me when you said ejection fraction, etc. The muscle, back to the muscle again. The I saw something that really surprised me that the you actually get with space flight, and I guess with bed rest as well, you actually get an increase in the velocity of contraction. Yeah.
Yes.
And then you've talked about something to do with the less thin myofilaments and affecting the lattice structure or something.
Yeah. So early on, the studies we're doing with the space flight, and these were fibers were studied in Fitz's lab. And then Danny Riley had some really cool microanatomy EM work he was doing. And if you look at a normal person, they have 6 actin per myosin. So you just look at this myosin and be a wheel with all the actin around it. And after 2.5 weeks up in space, it was the ratio went from 6 to 1, 5 to 1. So the idea was that the overall proteins, the packing in there wasn't as tight. So it gave more operating room for the myosin head so it could cock and recock and fire faster. But then when we did 6 months, it's like it was stabilized. It was back to 6 to 1. So look, it looks like it's a transient thing. It's probably going on with the muscle adaptation, overall turnover. These are different sized proteins, right? The, you know, myosin's 520 kilodaltons, actin's, you know, 30, 40 kilodaltons. I should know the number. I don't know off the top of my head. It's a lot smaller, right? So you look at over protein turnover, these different proteins and whatnot. That probably influenced some of that ratio stuff that was happening early on that we thought was going to project into a long-term problem that after 6 months, it looked like it was stabilized. We didn't see that same architecture.
And that's not just the, because you could think, oh, the velocity of the contraction is going up because they're getting more fast fibers, but that's within the slow and the fast, right? They're both.
Correct. Yeah. Combination, more fast fibers, but then within the same fiber type, you're seeing an increase in contractile velocity, which drives power.
So power, yeah, so that would be another thing of sort of maintaining the power a bit, yeah?
Yeah, so I think what's happening with the velocity, it's offsetting the shrinking. And so you do start to see atrophy of the cell size, right? So the fibers are shrinking, but they're getting faster. So sometimes you might not see an increase in power, you just see a preservation of power. And some of this, it's kind of interesting. Not many people do this, and we don't do them here, but I tend to get lost in the literature and reading some of this work, Robert Cook's work and different people, just looking at the efficiency of these fibers that probably happen. And there's some really interesting stuff going on that, with the myosin in different states, right? The typical state where it would bound and then unbound would be relaxed, right? I think most people are familiar with it, textbook classic undergrad stuff. But then they've identified a new kind of like 10-15% of this could be what's super relaxed. So then the myosin head's really laid down, tucked in further away. And then in some people that are really fit, there's that ratio changes where you have it even more super relaxed. Mm-hmm. And it changes the overall, it apparently metabolically, it's more efficient to operate that way. So there may be some really unique sort of, sub protein changes that are happening on there that are actually helping drive efficiency. Some of this may happen. The stuff I've been looking at with this is more like in runners. So this could be normal athletes. that this is happening on, and where they get, you know, over time, economy and all these things improve a little bit, where the fibers themselves are becoming actually a bit more efficient in their operation. And I think some of that same stuff is probably the remodeling that's going on in the architecture of the muscle. I wouldn't be surprised if some of this stuff's happening in these unique environments like space.
Yeah. So when I was talking about the VO2 max, you know, the classic thing is, you know, what determines performance, what is, you know, your VO2 max, your lactate threshold, your efficiency, your economy. So, you know, and I thought, oh, I won't really go into that, but is there an effect, you know, so you said you get them submax, you know, within a day or two exercising. Do you see any change in efficiency? You probably wouldn't pick it up on a whole body level. Do you see any change in efficiency of their exercise, you know, if these potentially changes in actin to myosin ratios and
not really. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I think the biggest thing, depending on where you're at in the submax, is, you know, you just stroke volumes down, so the heart rate makes up for it. But if you get to a submaximal load, it could be approaching max. So you start to see a lot of changes. And typically the other thing that'll happen is you'll see at a submaximal load, you'll see more of a drive for carbohydrate flux than you would free fatty acid flux, because it's just the overall intensity is higher. So as a result, it's a higher carbohydrate.
That's true. So that could affect your oxygen. That would make you slightly more efficient as well. So there isn't really changes in VO2, you know, per unit work or something.
No, 150 watts is still 150 watts, right? So you're going to, you know, if you're cycling at 150 watts in the ground before you go to space, assuming normal bike, recumbent changes these dynamics a bit. But if you're in a normal bike,
that's 150 true.
Watts, you're going to be around 2.1 liters. Absolute.
Exactly right.
In space, you're the same. It's 2.1 liters. You get back, it's 2.1 liters. Now, what's the stress of that? Because your max is down. So as a percentage of your max, that 150 liters became a lot higher. So what happens when you go at a higher intensity? Well, it's a higher strain on carbohydrate.
Yeah, that's the thing I always like to point out with students is, you know, if you're doing a VO2 max, it doesn't matter who you are, you know, the same workload, the VO2 is the same, but obviously you just start to plateau out and you get to your max earlier.
You just go on the line.
I mean, there's a slight differences in efficiency, but as you say, it's very small. Now, there was a question again from Mark Preben-Lindbach, but I think you touched on this earlier. He said, is there any plans, you know, new drug sort of agents to try and reduce atrophy and the osteocardiometabolic consequences of long periods of space? You're saying they're not really...
None that I'm aware of. I told you we played around with testosterone and bed rest study.
I don't see
that as a viable path for a variety of reasons. I do think the bone health is an issue. I know they've experimented with bisphosphonate and stuff with the crew members on orbit. I know there's some additional issues with the ladies and menstruating and not. They tend to clamp that when they're up there for long periods of time that may have some impact. So a little moving target in some of these things may require some therapies, but that's not their go-to. We'll just solve it with the drug, because like the example I gave you earlier, you know, okay, the high loads was great for muscle, but it wasn't great for the eye. We don't know the pharmacokinetics of these drugs in space environment, right? We're probably changing a lot of the organ communication, the pharmacokinetics of these drugs. So you just start taking this. And I know the crew member can take Advil, you know, things like that in space are readily available, you know, for the crew. But beyond that, if there's something going on with drug experiments, I'm not aware of them.
Actually, the other thing I was thinking was, you know, when you go to the gym, you know, you're lifting a weight, you're lifting it against gravity, it's concentric, and then you're lowering it, fighting gravity, it's eccentric. I guess you're not seeing any sort of eccentric loading up there, or do you manage
to do loading that? So the resistance exercise device has a fully eccentric
loading. The device, yes. Yes. Okay.
And then, you know, the runner, when they're on the treadmill, they've got a big harness on. Right? I'm sitting up like the harness is on. You can't see my waist, but they got a harness in the bungee cord that's tied to the treadmill. So you're weight bearing on the treadmill so you can actually run.
Of course, if you're running.
And you can adjust that. So I'd be like half body weight, one body weight or whatever. And, you know, with running, there's a fair, decent eccentric load. Right. And depending on how much loading you have would dictate the eccentric load during running. With cycling, obviously, that's all concentric. Yeah. So they do quite a bit of eccentrics in space,
true.
The resistance in the
treadmill. Perfect. All right. Now, that's great. So you've done a whole bunch of other stuff, a lot of aging stuff we sort of touched on. Is there anything else that you're like excited about at the moment that you're working on? Just give you a chance to, what are you excited about at the moment? Apart from being on the podcast.
I'm excited. I'm an exercise physiologist. This is a great way to make a living.
And what a job. Full stack.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Mm-hmm. We've just been fortunate. My whole career from the people I've worked with, the people I'm surrounded with now. Mm-hmm. Right now, the National Institutes of Health in the United States, in 2016, we applied to a grant for a big consortium to look at the health benefits of exercise. We know exercise is good for you, but we don't know all the molecules that are driving that. So this is a 32 university, it's a huge team consortium. We've been working on that. It took 4 years of planning to do that till about 2020. 2019, we launched the initial studies. We're taking, our goal is to get around 2,000 individuals that are sedentary, but healthy, bring them into the program, and they get randomized to do either 12 weeks of endurance exercise, which
2000.
Is
2,000.
Yep. Well, half of those would do endurance, mm-hmm. or a little less than half would do endurance, which is 50% treadmill, 50% bike. Another cohort gets randomized into resistance exercise. We got, it's a whole body routine, 8 exercises, 5 upper body, 3 lower body. Takes about an hour. The aerobic takes about an hour, about 80% of heart rate reserve for the aerobic, and sort of 70-80% effort, on the muscle. Good stimulus. We know it grows the muscle. And then we have a comparative control group that does nothing, so we can look at those changes over time. And then we have a comparative group of highly trained aerobic people and highly trained resistance exercise to compare to. But with the pandemic, we had to stop for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
We got started again in late 2020 with some highly actives, and then the sedentary started that fall. So MotorPAC is going to be going, it's Molecular Transducers of Physical Activity Consortium, MotorPAC. We would have about 2.5 years more of data collection to complete our cohorts. Everything's going well right now. So our job as a clinical center is to recruit these people, pre-test them, train them, and post-test them. And the pre-testing is quite involved. So we have them come in and do a standardized exercise bout. It's either on the bike in the lab at 65% of VO2 max, or this whole body resistance routine.
Mm-hmm.
We're taking muscle biopsies and blood draws for a variety of different things, muscle biopsies and adipose biopsies. And then we have timing. We capture, they do the exercise bout, then we repeat that again, either early in this early window, about 4 hours or 24 hours to capture that dynamic response. Train them for 12 weeks, do it again. And then this all gets sent to a central biorepository in Vermont. They catalog everything, grind it up, and then they're sending it out to 7 different genetic sites for genetics, transcriptomics, methylomics, proteomics, multi-omic stuff. And then all that stuff gets sent to a central informatics center, which is hosted at Stanford for the bioinformatics. And with all the phenotype data we have to stitch all that together. So that's been consuming me for some time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm loving the project and the team we have here in the bigger consortium. And I think it's, and then when we're all done, this will be all released, all the data unidentified in a big database for the general public, scientists worldwide. Wow. So it's a bit of a service project that's being funded, a major, major investment in exercise by the National Institutes of Health here in the United States.
Yeah, it's amazing. I couldn't believe when that happened. So you're saying 2,000, because we often get criticized for doing study. We've got biopsies and fusing traces and whatever, and you have N=8. People are like, N=8. They used to like epidemiological studies, 30,000, whatever. And it's like you can't have 30,000, but 2,000, that's a huge N. for all that.
It's a huge end. And, you know, I think at the end, if you look at the history of our field, you know, this year is the 100-year anniversary of VO2max by A.V. Hill.
Wow,
and then if you look at the reintroduction of the muscle biopsy technique in 1962, the studies we were fortunate to be involved with here at the lab, Copenhagen and others around the world, you guys down in Australia, those small end studies opened the door for MotorPack, right? We knew what was going on. We knew how dynamic this response was. These small scale studies, Halazi's lab, right? All that's just opened the doors. And so one of the things we're interested that we can get at with this larger study that we can, if we're just doing it at Ball State, you can get into deeper phenotyping. We're going to have men, women, minority groups, and we're going to be able to look at the heterogeneity and the response. We're going to look at how that links to the genetic profile of these individuals in their exercise response that you just can't do in the small scale studies. So it's a wonderful opportunity to be involved in this. I love it.
Did you say there's like 35 labs involved or something? What did you say?
I think 32 institutions.
32 so institutions.
There's 10 human clinical centers. We wrote a manual of operating procedures. It's 720 pages. So we're operating as one big lab.
Wow.
Okay. Everything is documented. When you take a muscle biopsy, this is how it's processed at Ball State. This is how it's processed at Florida. This is how it's processed at Colorado and so forth. The VO2 tests, everything's the same. So we're operating as one big unit. And then you have all the genetics labs I was talking about that specialize in their, you know, transcriptomics, proteomics, whole genome sequencing, fossil proteomics, and then all that gets funneled in. And then I think the other novel part of MotorPack is including the adipose biopsies.
Really
look at, you know, the dynamic aspect of adipose in this whole situation. It's relatively new on the scene compared to the muscle biopsy, which has 60 years of research behind it. And when you look at it, you know, it's more or less been tied up in obesity research. So really to do add this on and expand it out into a healthy cohort and how the adipose depot may be changing with different modes of training is going to be phenomenal. I think the other smart thing MotorPack did, or NIH did for MotorPack, was they have aerobic and resistance exercise. As you know, the history of our field has been heavily endurance-based in terms of its studies, with resistance exercise coming behind. So to really compare and contrast those modes of exercise and their health benefits across these platforms and these procedures in these individuals, I think will also be another awesome comparison to really get at the two most common modes of exercise that people might do.
Someone's going to come along and say, what about if you do both? But you've got to stop somewhere. That's already massive, right?
Well, I think that this opens the door for that. So this is going to be a public database, petabyte of data per subject. It's going to be out there de-identified.
Yeah.
So now it's going to be this blueprint, this initial map, molecular map of the health of the responses to exercise in untrained and trained state and then highly trained individuals. You could come behind and say, what if we did do concurrent training? Concurrent training works for NASA. In fact, when we did our studies, you go back with the Hickson lab and what they did back in 1980, they looked like it was interfering. When you do unloaded muscle, the aerobic and resistance are actually, in fact, complementary. So what if you did do concurrent? What if I have a disease state that I wanted to look at and lay on top of that? So I think this is going to be a rich data source for the field worldwide.
I don't know if you know off the top of your head, but how many million dollars was that? And how many years of funding is it?
Well, we started in 2016. We're still going. So these common fund projects tend to be 10 years. I think the initial investment was $350 million.
Wow.
But that's been expanded a bit to do a few extra things in the consortium. And then because of the pandemic, NIH has put some additional resources on the table. We're going through a grant mechanism right now to extend MotorPack to complete the initial, as it was originally envisioned, to get the full cohort in place. So I think when it's all said and done, this will be north of $400 million.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Well, I don't know. We've got through, I think, quite a lot of things. It's been great. We normally at the end I do what are some takeaway messages? I don't know if you really have takeaway. What are the takeaway? I guess if someone was going to ask you like what happens when you go up in space and how does exercise help or doesn't exercise help? Is there like a short summary you give?
Well, we wouldn't be able to survive in space without it for long periods of time. Even when you go back to John Glenn's first mission, they had a little bungee cord and they had him pull on it.
Okay.
For 30 seconds. They didn't know how the heart was going to respond under loads. Is the heart going to blow up or not? So exercise has been part of the culture from the very beginning. Right. It's part of the solution going forward. It may not be the only solution. I'm not saying that, but it's hard to envision space exploration without exercise. And I think that message then filtrates back into Earth base. I think we were evolved as exercisers from the hunter-gatherer model. I think exercise is lacking. You know, they've engineered physical activity out of a lot of children's programs and different things. So, I'm biased, but, for me, exercise is therapeutic in a lot of ways. It's medicine for physical, mental health, and a little goes a long way, I think, would be probably the take-home message we've learned from the space environment. Consistency is king, and a little goes a long way.
It's funny you mentioned John Glenn, is because a lot of people are called Glenn after that. So that's where they decided to call me Glenn. So 1962,
I think, just you and I are just trying to practice what we preach. I'm fortunate to have exercise part of my lifestyle. I do it every day. I was telling you earlier, Dave's 87. He's down at the pool 3-4 days a week. He's still swimming, not as fast as he once was or he'd like to be, but he's still doing intervals, still training like an athlete, and it's inspirational to be around people that have continued with it. And then to see the benefits, when you look at like when we've done some of the aging athlete people in their 70s and 80s, they may be 80 years old, but physiologically they're 40 years old.
Yes.
Wow. There's a lot of benefits here. So it'll be interesting to see.
It's nice.
I think the future for the field is bright. I think a lot of cultures are coming together. The big thing with MotorPack is the cultures are coming together. So we're getting together with these omics individuals and they're getting together with the exercise individuals. We couldn't have done this on our own. We're learning a lot from each other. And I think we're going to create new paths going forward for a lot of this stuff and understanding how the body adapts to exercise.
Well, it's nice sort of starting with David Costell and maybe finishing up a bit with David Costell. So, when you talk about his swimming in 87, it was probably 10 years ago, he was down in Melbourne for a swimming conference and he came out to Victoria University and I managed to get him in the pool there. And he was doing like butterfly, the guy's like 70, must have been 77, 78. He's doing butterfly, just smashing it. I couldn't believe it because my phone was always maxed out. I never had like room. And I'm like trying to delete stuff and film the guy, And anyway, just perfect form, But then he gets out. And he goes, oh, my bloody back. He said, I can't use my legs at all. And I'm like, what? You're kidding me. Your back hurts so much you can't use your legs. So you're doing that all butterfly with your arms? Holy mackerel. So I think that's a pretty good. Is he still he had world record, didn't he, for his age in the medley or something?
Yeah, but I think, one of the things with the pandemic, it slowed down. Nobody could compete. In fact, the thing, we couldn't get in the pool. All the pools and stuff were closed around here for like a year. So we had to go to other modes of exercise. What do you do in these days for exercise?
I mainly cycle. Yeah, I've started going to the gym a bit. I was actually, to be honest, I was inspired by Michael Joyner. He said he feels that he's 65, I think, and he said he wants to get his kind of peak muscle mass by 70, which is when you really starts to drop off at a great rate. I thought that's a good. I'm 60. I thought, okay, I might start doing that. But yeah, usually just cycling. Actually, thank you for all the rides on and stuff you give me. Like, I'm not the best at doing that on Strava. It's great.
Strava is a great community. I love, something like yourself being on there and senior activities and just knowing the graduates that move on. It's one of the nice ways to stay connected because everybody more or less exercises. So it's sort of like, I sort of have a general rule with Strava in the lab with my students. They all come in, want to follow me and stuff. So I don't care. Go ahead. Mine's public, but I don't follow them back. And they're like, oh, and I said, when you graduate, I'll follow you back. And they're like, why is that? I said, at some point in the program, the pressure is going to be on. You're going to be up a deadline. And if you don't meet it, I don't need to see that you were out for a 40-mile bike ride.
Oh, there you go. Right. Yeah. And I mentioned Todd very briefly earlier. He's like he goes and does, he seems to do like crazy amounts. I haven't
looked at that lately. Todd's super fit on the bike right now. He's an absolute horse. He did a ride last week. He was an hour and a half. He averaged 250 watts for the whole ride.
Right. Wow. Hour and a half, 250 watts. And then you did an Ironman, right? Because when I had Brett Goodpaster on, you both were about to do an Ironman.
Yeah, so that came out of the pandemic. So I grew up, I was a college swimmer and I did triathlons back in that era. And then, you know, life got busy, family, all that stuff. I kind of was a single sport athlete. And then I was maybe 45, got back into triathlon again. Then I was getting really fit and competitive with it, kind of at the pointy tip of my age group. Whoever came up with the 5-year increments with age groups is a genius. And then when coming out of the pandemic, I'd done a lot of training during the pandemic, more cycling than normal, just because, you know, you had extra time on your hands. And they introduced a full Ironman here in town in Muncie. You know, the history of Ironman comes through Muncie, that they have the oldest half distance Ironman in the world. And really? So they decided, at the reservoir here. And as a result, we got a nice local race series and stuff. So it's great. Wow. So I was like, what a better opportunity. We're going to add one here in Muncie, a full Ironman. I'm like, well, if I'm going to do one, because I had never done the full one. I'd done everything up through a half. And I was like, this is the time. I get to sleep in my own bed. And then Brett and I, being buddies back from grad school, still communicate and compete together and all that stuff, said, let's do it. So we signed up together. And he came back. So that would have been 2 years ago. I loved it. I loved the training for it. I loved the process of training for it. And frankly, I had the time. I knew professionally I wasn't going to have to travel because, you know, all that kind of was shut down. Lab operations were back open. So I had the time to train and recover, and it was fun. But now it's sort of life. I'm training pretty hard right now. I'm fit. I'll be racing this summer, our summer up here in the Northern Hemisphere. But I don't really have the time to fully manage all the training for a full. And I'm glad I did it. I really liked it. But I like racing. And the Ironman's more just do it, like checking it off. It's kind of, you're not really racing for, you know, whatever, however long it takes you to do that event. Whereas like my favorite distance is probably the Olympic distance. You're racing. And I tend to enjoy, you know, that overall environment. I may do one again, you know, a full one down the road, but I start thinking about the pounding, the joint health and all that's required under the training and stuff. And you just sort of like, oh, okay, I did it. And if I did another one, it'd be kind of a classic course or, you know, something along those lines. But I'm perfectly content with doing sprint Olympics are great because you just get to drill it and race people. And the half's kind of fun. The half has really grown because I think people don't have time to really do the full.
Yeah.
That was sold as this glory thing. And then I think the branding and the expansion of the 70.3, it's really, really competitive. So there's a lot
it's going more on cheap in
that space as well. Yeah. And then the nice thing is, you know, at the lab, I'm surrounded by people 25 years younger than me that are good athletes. So they help keep me in shape.
It's funny. I remember the reservoir. I used to love riding around the reservoir, or you either did that or you went out in the cornfields. It's just totally flat, you know. But I was a runner. It was actually just before I went to Ball State, I got injured with my knee and it screwed me up. And I just remembered while you were talking, I didn't quite get it somehow. You know, I had like a physio appointment. You know, there was a lab meeting every week, same time. My physio appointment was during the lab meeting. So I just went to the physio appointment. You don't do that. That is not general practice.
I will say there's the lab environment is pretty liberal and people, it's the exercise culture. You do this, you do that, but there's few anchor points you just don't miss.
Exactly. I don't know what I was thinking now. I'm right. Like, what if someone did that? And then the other one, I remember Frank Pike again, back to my undergrad. It was like raining outside, so I decided I'd run on the treadmill. You know, I'm like an undergrad. He's like, and I said, oh, it's raining outside. He went, just go outside and run in the rain then. Like, again, I'm like, what am I thinking? Like an undergrad, just jumping on the treadmill to run because it's raining outside.
Yeah.
Okay, mate. Well, it's been great seeing you and great having you on. And Really interesting
to see
stuff.
Glenn, I'd like to see you in person here. Do you,
yeah, exactly.
You got any travel plans for meetings, or maybe I need to somehow figure out a trip to come down there and see the Ball State crew?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm going to Copenhagen for 6 months in the middle of May. So I've had all these sabbaticals and things. I don't know if you call it a sabbatical now, and I'm not really, but I've been lucky enough that, so I've got this Danish Diabetes Academy visiting professorship. So it's meant I've gone over there for like 6 months a few times on other funding, but then 2019 was 6 months on that fellowship. And then there was money left over. And then I then like took a package and I left full-time academia. And I contacted them thinking they wouldn't, you know, let me come back. And they said, oh, I hope you come back. You know, I hope you can still come. It's like, oh, sure. So, I'm going to go, my wife and I, and then the kids will come over for a bit in May for 6 months. But I have been in communication with Andy Coggins, was saying, you know, he's maybe got some money that I can come and hang out in his lab for a bit. So, you know, that's in Indiana as well. So I'd love to.
Well, if you'd ever like to come hang out and do another stint in the lab, just let me know. We can help make that happen.
Stick me in bed for like 6 months. No,
you're going to come here and train. We're going to get you fit. We're going to be tested on your visit.
Exactly.
So, right. Who are you working with when you're in Copenhagen?
Now, Eric Richter mainly, but also Jan Modicheski. So,
okay. You know, so do you guys have some experiments and stuff planned?
Yeah. So the other times I've gone, we've had specific projects with grants and things. But now, again, because I stopped officially working as an academic in December 2020. Now it's more, so I don't have grants and we don't have a specific project. So it's more like, it sounds like I'm just going to be sort of helping out with projects.
Yeah, go over there, help out, just integrate in the scene and get into it.
Yeah, and I'll be
that's
like
awesome
a
too.
Thinker in residence, you know, sort of have input on people's
studies. Well, I joke when Bob Fitz, he officially retired and then he was pushing to get an R01 NIH funded grant, like to study some aging stuff, which he got funded and he worked it out with the university to keep his lab space operational. So I said, well, Bob, you're like a postdoc again.
Exactly.
Right? You get to do all the fun stuff with science without sort of the administrative
component. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right? All right. So yeah, I can come, you can put me to work there, man. Okay.
Absolutely.
Great to see you. Maybe we'll go and catch up another band or something. But good on you, mate.
Sounds good, Glenn. Thanks for having me on. Congratulations on the success of your podcast.
Yeah.
And have a wonderful time over in Copenhagen.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. See
all
you,
right,
mate.
Take care,
buddy.
Bye-bye. Yep. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.